Jodcast, coming soon to an asteroid near you, with Liz Guzman, Philippa Hartley, India Clerk, Tim O'Brien, and Christina Smith. The Jodcast, April 2013, Extra Edition. Hello and welcome to the Jodcast. I'm India Clerk, and joining me today are Christina Smith and Philippa Hartley. Hi guys.
Hello.
Hello.
In the show this time, we talk to Professor Paola Caselli about emission from star-forming regions, and Dr. Tim O'Brien answers your astronomical questions. But first, before all of that, this month's JodBite. Liz Guzman interviews Professor Shude Mao about detecting exoplanets using gravitational microlensing.
For this month's JodBite, Professor Shude Mao talks to us about finding exoplanets using microlensing. Hi, Professor. Thank you for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. So tell us a little bit about finding exoplanets using microlensing.
Okay, maybe I should start with what is microlensing?
Yeah. Right?
So microlensing basically refers to the fact that a background source can be gravitationally magnified by an intervening object between you and the source. Okay, of course, this sort of microlensing effect does not happen every day. In fact, it's very, very rare. It only happens once for 1 million stars.
Okay.
So in the past, it's very difficult to observe this phenomenon. But with modern computers and CCD technology in astronomy, it becomes now routinely possible to find microlensing events from a haystack, let's say, to find a needle in the haystack, okay? So if you monitor hundreds of millions of stars, you will see many gravitational microlensing events. It turns out for a few percent of these events, you also have signatures for extrasolar planets. So for normal microlensing events, you see a bell-shaped light curve.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, causing shaped light curve, and when an extrasolar planet is present, you see an extra bump or dip in the light curve, and this is the sort of feature we try to observe in order to infer the presence of extrasolar planets.
Okay, so. To go by a little bit of history, I know that you predicted some numbers back in the 90s.
Right, that was actually my first published paper.
Okay.
So at that time, in 1991, no microlensing events have been observed.
Yeah.
These days, about 10,000, more than 10,000 microlensing events have been observed. But at that time, no event was seen, but I was a starting PhD student working with Professor Bohdan Paczynski at Princeton. So one day we were sitting in his office chatting about microlensing possibilities, and he said to me, you know, who knows, it may even be possible to see extrasolar planet signatures in microlensing events.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard his comments, and I just went away and did some calculations, because he didn't suggest this as a thesis topic to me.
Yeah.
I was working on something else. But it turns out it's very easy to work it out, and I did it in a few days. Mm-hmm. And we made the prediction that the extrasolar planet should be present in about a few percent of all the microlensing events you see. And this prediction turns out to be almost exactly what we see today. And it's very rewarding to see that something you predict on a piece of paper actually turns out to be true in nature. I think this is one of the most exciting episodes in my life.
Of course.
Okay.
So about these microlensing events, so you, what about if you have a binary system? Do you also see the other star if it's eclipsing, right? Or how do you know if it's an exoplanet or another star?
Right. Actually, in the same paper, we made the prediction for binary microlens events as well. So this is one star orbiting another star.
Yeah.
And it turns out the event rate for this sort of binary microlens event is also similar to that of for extrasolar planets. Now you can tell whether it's a binary star or planet because the perturbation provided by the planet is much shorter than a typical binary star. So for a Jupiter-sized planet, the perturbation is of the order 1 day. And for an Earth-sized planet, it's of the order a few hours. But for a normal star, the perturbation is much, much longer and potentially much stronger.
Okay. And can you get any, I don't know, any parameters from the planet, from the signal, apart from the periodicity, I guess?
Right. So for binary stars, the light curves can be very, very diverse, can be of many, many different shapes. For extrasolar planets, the light curves can also be complicated, but can be somewhat simpler to model. So from modeling of these light curves, what you get is normally the mass ratio between the two lenses. So in this case, we have the primary star and the planet. So we can get the mass ratio between the planet and the primary star.
Okay.
And we can also get the separation in units of typical length in gravitational microlens, so-called Einstein radius, because Einstein, first correctly worked it out in 1936. So it's called Einstein ring. So these are the two parameters we get, mass ratio and the separation.
Okay, very good. So you predicted all these numbers, and then what telescopes are they used to observe these microlensing events?
That's a very interesting question. In fact, the telescope used are not very large. The larger one is of the order 2 meter class telescope because we are observing primary stars close to the galactic center. So we are not observing objects at cosmological distances. So these stars are relatively bright. So you can observe with modest aperture telescopes, 1 to 2 meter class telescope. But you have to monitor these stars quite densely because a typical microlensing event lasts only for about a month. It can be shorter.
Okay.
So you need to observe at least once a day. So you have to have a long-term monitoring program to discover these microlensing events and to catch the perturbation of the planet. Then you need high cadence. But here, there's a very interesting effect coming in because in microlensing, the stars are magnified.
Yeah.
So in fact, some of these events are highly magnified by a factor of 100 or even more.
Okay.
So these stars will be very bright. And some of these can be observed by amateur telescopes. So 20 centimeter or 30 centimeter telescopes. In fact, many amateurs participated in the discovery of extrasolar planets with microlensing because you need to cover the light curves very densely, and the contributions of these amateurs are actually very significant. So the apertures can range from tens of centimeters all the way up to a 2 meter class telescope.
Oh, wow. Is there any program at the moment that is monitoring a lot of stars?
Right.
A lot of different programs.
Actually, mostly the discovered extrasolar planets currently can be divided into two parts. One is so-called survey program.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is follow-up program. So the survey teams have to survey large pieces of sky in order to discover these microlensing events. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the world-leading collaboration, the Polish collaboration OGLE, discovers about maybe 1,600 microlensing events per year. And all these events are in real time, so they can be found in the OGLE website. Now, once these events are discovered, we want to catch the small deviation produced by extrasolar planets.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The convenient thing is that now these events are discovered in real time, it means that we can pick the most interesting events to follow up to discover extrasolar planet deviations, and currently, most of the events selected are high magnification events.
Okay.
So they are highly magnified at the peak of the light curve. These stars are very bright, so they are actually observable by amateur telescopes. So you have survey teams that discover these thousands of microlens events per year, and then you have follow-up teams mm-hmm. that can study selected microlensing events much more densely. So this is divided into two parts. Currently, there are two survey teams, OGO and MO, and there are quite a number of small telescopes used to follow up these selected events.
Okay. And just for curiosity, the population, do you find more exoplanets in the center of the galaxy or towards... What about the anti-center? Has anyone observed the anti-center?
Right. Because the event is so low, it's one out of a million. So these survey teams, OGO and MO, actually mostly observe the galactic center, where the stellar density is very, very high.
Yeah.
In fact, not many teams have, well, no team, in fact, has observed the anti-galactic center. But there have been teams who observed spiral arms quite far away from the galactic center. They found some events, but the event rate is quite low, so people now mostly concentrate towards the galactic center.
Okay. It makes sense. Okay, so just for numbers, you said that they found 1,600 events per year.
Right, these are broadcasted on the internet, 1,600. Okay. Maybe a comparable number, maybe in the archive.
Yeah.
Because not every event can be identified in the real time.
Yeah. So these are candidates, let's say.
These are candidates. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But maybe a small fraction of these candidates are variable stars, but the vast majority are gravitational microlensing events. And when some events have data from both OGO and MO collaborations, they always agree with each other. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you for the interview, Professor. Thank you for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for that, Liz. Now, we have Christina talking to Professor Caselli about emission from star-forming regions.
Joining me in the studio today is Professor Paola Caselli from the University of Leeds, and she was just giving a talk about star formation and water. So can you just tell us a little bit about what you're working on?
Okay, with pleasure. So I work on the very early stages of star formation, so try to understand the physical structure and chemical composition just before a star and protoplanetary disk is born. And this is, of course, is very important for us because we need these measurements and observations to constrain models of star formation.
You mentioned a protoplanetary disk. Can you just explain briefly?
Oh, sure. Okay. So when we talk about star formation, we have to consider that stars form within clouds. And clouds, as we can see also in clouds in our atmosphere, they have not very regular shapes, but we can consider or say approximate as, say, spheroidal type of objects. Now, these spheroidal type of objects, they have an initial rotation. So they rotate a bit, and at the same time, to form a star, of course, they have to contract. So if you put together these two things, contraction and rotation, something happens, because they are not solid bodies. They, kind of fluffy structures. So if you rotate and spin something that is not really a solid body, think about a pizza dough. What you get a flattened structure, and you get what we, in fact, we call a protoplanetary disk. So this is like a torus of material that will form around the center of, say, center of gravity where the star is going to form. And this torus that is just orbiting around the star is a very thick and dense region where there is dust and gas, the one that basically was in the cloud, the original cloud. But now what happened is that the density becomes so large that the dust grains start to coagulate and become bigger grains, and then at some point they will become pebbles and then rocks and then planetesimals, and then finally you form the planet. So all the factory that say to make planets is within these protoplanetary disks.
So this disk is a disk of material, like a ring of material, a torus.
Exactly.
Okay. Yes. Fantastic.
So what I have done so far, for example, among, you know, various results, one of the first things that we observe is that some of the molecules that we observe, and in particular carbon monoxide that is very abundant in these regions, appears to go away in the center, basically disappears in the center of these clouds, dark, dense regions where stars are going to form, but they have not formed yet. And the reason for that, it seems that the most likely event is that the CO molecules, they encounter very tiny little dust grains, like the ones that are in the air, but, you know, very tiny, like about in size, say, 1,000 times smaller than sand grains. And once they encounter these grains in these molecular clouds in the interstellar medium, where the temperatures are very low, they just stick on them, and they're not able to come off in the gas phase because there is not enough energy. The temperatures are in centigrades, it's like minus 260 degrees, so it's really freezing. And these dust grains, these little tiny dust particles, started to form nice ice mantles all around formed by these molecules that just come from the gas phase and stick on them. So this was one of the first results, and then we also measured something that is interesting for us in a sense that we also measure in water oceans. So in our Earth oceans, we know that the water, some of the water is heavy water, so it's HDO. And if one measure the ratio between HDO and the normal water, which is H2O, so D is the term. And so what we find is that this ratio is actually larger by about a factor of 10 compared to what we measured in our universe. So the cosmic abundance of the deuterium compared to hydrogen is, say, 10 times lower in the universe compared to our Earth ocean. So one thing that we wanted to measure is also this the so-called deuterium fraction. So how much deuterium, say, deuterated molecules there are compared to the more abundant normal hydrogenated molecules, to see if there is some correspondence between what we see at the early phases of star formation and what we see actually on Earth.
You mentioned deuterium, and deuterium is just hydrogen with an extra neutron in there.
Exactly. Yeah, it's just a heavy, like we call it one isotope of the hydrogen. So it's a heavier form of a hydrogen.
Okay.
So we couldn't measure the water until some years ago because it was very difficult, but we could measure other species and other deuterated species, and we in fact measure very high level of deuteration. That is something that really is a phenomenon that is linked to the fact that some species like CO molecules are frozen. There is some chemistry, so I'm not going to explain all the details on that, but it's really a one-to-one correlation. As you freeze out molecules from the gas phase to the dust, you increase the level of deuteration. So, of course, now what we want to do is to measure the deuteration in the water in these regions where there are not yet stars inside. And so, first of all, we measured the water, and this was thanks to Herschel Space Observatory, and so we needed very high sensitivity and also high spectral resolution. So this is something that we need to measure the profile of the line that we observe, because it's from the profile of the line that we can understand where the water is coming from within the cloud.
Just picking up on something you just said there. Yes. So you said you needed high spectral resolution, so you need to be able to see in detail the emission lines that you get. So these molecules are emitting a spectrum, or they're absorbing a spectrum.
Exactly. We see lines like, you know, when you do, we go to the doctor and do like electrocardiogram. This is kind of the type of lines that we see. And if we want to see like all the peaks and all the profile of the line, we need to sample the line with high resolution. And that is the so-called, say, spectral resolution. And Herschel had a very powerful spectrometer that was able to sample the line at a very small fraction of, kilometer per second, which is actually what we need to explore regions where motions are very tiny, because these are regions very quiescent, very cold, where nothing really happens yet, but it's going to happen because it's like we call them like a cradle for the star. So the width of the line depends on how fast the molecules move inside. So we typically see very, very narrow lines because there is very tiny little motion.
So, when you're looking at these lines, you see sort of an emission intensity against a velocity.
Right, yes. So we have like the line is like a bell line. So we have an intensity and also a width, and the width depends on the motions of the molecules within the cloud, because if you have a different motion, say for example if the molecules is approaching you, you will have like a blue shifted, and this is something that say it's every day we experience that with the, you know, Doppler effect that we experience when we have like a siren passing by and all this.
So it goes from being a higher pitch to a lower pitch.
Yes. So you can consider like in a cloud, like a mixture of many, many molecules all moving with a certain velocity that depends on the temperature as well of the cloud. So you will have like blue shifted emission from the molecules that are approaching you, red shifted emission from the molecules that are going away from you. So at the end, you see the collection of the motions, and then you see a broadened line that tells you also the temperature of the cloud, and if there are any systematic motion, like for example gravitational contraction, as we expect in these regions that are going to form stars. So we observe this water line that actually had a very specific profile that can be reproduced considering in fact this contraction motion. And from the profile, the emission, and also a bit of absorption that we observed, that we were able to measure the abundance profile of the water across the cloud, and we could measure the abundance. So we measure like water vapor abundance that was about half Earth mass, which doesn't sound very big because, you know, the cloud is huge compared to, say, the Earth mass. We talk, in fact, about the total mass of the cloud bit more than 5 solar masses.
So this cloud is really huge.
It's a larger cloud that is probably going to form a star similar to our sun.
How far does it spread? Like how large is that?
Right. So the size is about say a bit more than 10,000 astronomical units. And this is interesting because if it's probably 15 in radius, 15 astronomical units.
And by astronomical units, you mean the distance?
The distance between, the Sun and the Earth. And this is a very interesting, actually, number, because if we think about our own solar system, if we think about what is the largest, structure that we have in our solar system, we have this so-called Oort cloud that is a collection of small rocks and comets, icy worlds basically, and this Oort cloud is supposed to have actually a radius a bit larger than that, but around say 20,000-30,000 AU possibly. We don't really know exactly, but so this gives us say some kind of link between say the size of our solar system and the size of this cloud. So we have material basically to form even more say material to form a star like our sun and the planetary system, our planets. We also know that some of the material of these clouds is going to blow away, because once the protostar, so the young star, future sun, will form, it will form with very strong winds, and the strong winds are going to blow away part of the material. So it's good that we actually have extra, because then we can use the material to form most likely like a planetary system like our own. And we know that there is plenty of water, not in the gas phase, so the water vapor, as I said, is only half Earth masses, but this implies a ice water, so water in solid form, that is more than 2 Jupiter masses. So we have plenty of water.
Any gas or any liquid, then you won't actually pick this up in the...
Exactly, because these are gas phase fissures. So this is the line that we are observing is from water molecules that are rotating in the gas phase. So we can see the ice. Water ice has been seen toward the molecular clouds, clouds, but much less dense than the one that we are seeing. Because to see something in ice, you have to see fissures in absorption. And these fissures in absorption, especially for the water ice, are in the near-infrared regime. Near-infrared means that you have to have not, say, too much dust along the line of sight, because the near-infrared photons can be absorbed quite soon. So you can see absorption fissure looking at the background stars, so stars that are behind the cloud that you're looking at. You look at the spectrum of the star, and then the spectrum of the star shows these absorption fissures. And if they are close to 2 micron, so sorry, the units, this is a little bit, but it's say in the near infrared regime, without going into too many details.
And by near infrared, you mean the area of the spectrum in the infrared that is closest to the visible,
exactly. And so we see these broad absorption bands that can be reproduced exactly in the laboratory with water. So that's a very neat result from other groups. So we know that there is some water ice, but how much, for example, in this pre-stellar course that these clouds that are going to form stars, we couldn't know, because if we look at toward the center, the extinction due to the dust is so large that we can't see any background star at all.
So all of the background is actually being absorbed by things exactly. that are in front of all of the emissions.
Exactly. It's completely dark. It's completely dark. In the, say, the light of the stars are, say, dimmed by orders of magnitude. So we would need, like, very, very powerful telescopes that don't even exist at the
moment.
That's
like 10 or 100?
100,000 times. So it's really large. It's really large. So the only way to measure the water was through this water vapor in the far infrared. And actually, we needed a satellite, because water lines in the far infrared cannot be observed from the ground, because the water that we have in the atmosphere, they just absorb everything. That's why we needed Herschel to go up there and look at that.
Far infrared, by far infrared, we just mean the area in the spectrum, the infrared, which is furthest.
But exactly, yes. In fact, it is near and far is exactly like that refer to our, you know, visible range of wavelengths that we are very well used to. So yes, as you said before, near is the one, the part of the infrared that is close to the visible spectrum, and far is actually farther out. We are getting close, say, if we move even farther, we are getting close to radio. So the wavelength, it means the wavelength of the line gets larger and larger until we reach the radio. So now the next step will be to actually measure HDO, and for that we just got some observing time with the APEX antenna, which is in the Atacama Desert, next to the big ALMA, the large millimeter array in Chile at high latitudes. So we hope that we can observe and detect the HDO, and then measure the HDO over H2O ratio, and then it will constrain this ratio at the very beginning, before a star and planet form.
Okay. Thank you very much for telling us all about your work.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for that, Christina. Now we come to the part of the show where we fit in all those other things that we can't fit in anywhere else, the odds and ends.
The Keck Observatory in Hawaii is being used to find out where water in Saturn's upper atmosphere is coming from. Researchers have found out that the water comes from rain falling from Saturn's rings. This ring rain helps to explain why electron density in some regions of the planet's ionosphere is reduced. This electron density shows up as glowing from the ions in the atmosphere, and it can be seen in the infrared band. This effect is observed as a series of light and dark bands in a pattern mimicking the planet's rings, and it's led researchers to conclude that charged water particles from the rings are being drawn towards the planet's surface, neutralizing glowing hydrogen ions.
Cool. So there's water in Saturn's upper atmosphere that they've been trying to figure out how it got there. Is that the basis of this research?
That's right. It's long been known that there's water in the atmosphere, but no one's known where it's come from until now.
So it's literally just raining down from Saturn's rings onto the upper atmosphere.
That's right. So it's charged water particles coming from the rings. I think the ring particles are about 100 miles above the atmosphere.
So okay. they're coming from the rings down onto Saturn itself.
That's right.
Well, that would make for a lot more interesting rain in Manchester if we had stuff coming from rings around the Earth rather than just the clouds.
So how are they actually detecting? You said it was through light and dark patches. Is it as the particles collide with the ionosphere they give off?
It's actually that in the infrared, you can already see glowing coming from Saturn's surface, and that's due to ions in the surface already. And the water actually neutralises these ions, so produces dark patches, dark bands.
Okay, so it's sort of like absorption rather than emission.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
That's really cool. Staying in the solar system, my odd and or end is about NASA's recent proposal to bag an asteroid from somewhere in the solar system and bring it back to Earth orbit. This was announced recently as part of NASA's budget for 2014, and so they've been allocated $105 million towards this asteroid recovery program. And essentially they would want to grab an asteroid from an as yet undetermined location in the solar system, bring it back to Earth orbit, and then study its composition and basically be able to look at the asteroid in situ, as opposed to studying fragments that appear on Earth that have been burnt up through the atmosphere and things like that. So the details are still very sketchy. It's early days yet, but they plan to use a probe powered by ion thrusters. So it's essentially accelerating ions which are found in space and producing thrust through that mechanism. Finding an asteroid, surrounding it with some sort of bag or mesh, I suppose, and then towing it back home, really.
Cool. And has the ion technology been used before?
It has. It's not completely new. NASA has a couple of probes that use it, including the Dawn probe, which just spent a year orbiting the asteroid Vesta, which is massive, and then now it's looking at the dwarf planet Ceres. The asteroid they're planning on catching, though, is a lot smaller. It's going to be about 8 meters in diameter, so really tiny on astronomical scales. But anything bigger would be a bit difficult to tow back. So. Mm.
I have to say, I read this on the 1st of April, and I assumed it was an April Fool's Day joke, as I guess several other people probably did.
Yeah.
Do they have any more information about how they're going to actually grab it? Are they just sort of going to latch onto it or pull it or wrap something around it?
So I think the plan is to wrap something around it to get it with a sort of bag. So they're going to sort of, I don't know, trawl for it, and then, but they have to stabilize it, stop the asteroid's motion. So they're going to sort of use thrusters to kind of make it stay still and then drag it back using the ion spacecraft. Once it's in Earth orbit, so scientists and astronauts are going to jet up and visit it using the what's known as the Orion vehicle or space launch system. The Orion is already predicted to begin flying crews up into orbit by 2021. So that, along with the ISS, and they're going to go from there onto the asteroid. NASA are aiming to capture a specific type of asteroid called a carbonaceous chondrite, because they're the most compositionally diverse asteroids. So they've got loads of interesting complex organic molecules, they contain metals, and they're presumed to contain water as well. So all in all, yeah, that would be the most interesting thing to find. The problem is, the downside to that, is that they are also the asteroids that are the furthest away from Earth in the solar system. So the target remains to be determined.
So there could be lots of interesting science to come from this, possibly looking at the origin of life.
Yeah, there could actually be the possibility of either there being life on the asteroid somehow, which would of course be a huge discovery. If there isn't, there's also, you know, we could set up, maybe send some extremophile bacteria to see how it copes on the asteroid and whether, you know, living organisms could actually survive in space like that.
But the main thing they're looking at is the composition of the asteroid?
For now, that's the plan. I mean, as is the case with all big science projects, things are going to get fleshed out as they go along, really. And I think total final cost estimates are floating around the $2.5 billion mark. So it's only a very small step towards it, but I still think it's a pretty crazy but really cool idea.
I think it's awesome. So moving on, there has been some data released from Chandra, which is an X-ray telescope, and it's been looking at one of the Milky Way's closest galactic neighbours, which is called the Small Magellanic Cloud, which is a dwarf galaxy. And it's been looking at X-ray emission from young stars, which actually have masses that are somewhat close to the sun's mass. And it's the first time X-rays have been detected from stars of this size outside of our own galaxy. I mean, even it is a very close galactic neighbour, but still outside of our galaxy. The region it's been looking at is an area called the Wing, which is known to have fewer metals. And by metals, we mean elements that are heavier than hydrogen and helium, so not necessarily metals, as you may think in a day-to-day life. The Wing has fewer metals when compared with the Milky Way. So it's kind of interesting to have a look at how stars evolve in different environments, basically. And so far, they've seen that the young stars in this particular area, in this cluster called NGC 602A within the Wing, actually produce X-rays in a similar way to stars within our galaxy, which have a much higher metal content. The people who've done this research say that this could imply that there are other properties that they share that are not so dependent on the amount of metal content in the stars, which is a really exciting and interesting thing to have observed, really.
Cool.
And also, they've managed to put together a rather beautiful image using Hubble Space Telescope data and Spitzer Space Telescope data, which is an infrared telescope, along with the Chandra emission from the X-ray emission. And it's an absolutely gorgeous image.
Well, that's one of the main goals of astronomy, isn't it? To make really, really pretty pictures.
Wish my data came in pretty picture form.
So do we all. that really shows the point of observing at different wavelengths, because you really don't know everything about an object until you've looked at it through every possible telescope, I guess. I mean, there was a lot of data about the Small Magellanic Cloud already from other observations, but look at it in another wavelength and we discover all sorts of new interesting things. So.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much information that gets blocked out by things like dust clouds. So, I mean, if we were looking in the optical, dust would obscure a lot of what we see. So we look in the infrared to see through these dust clouds. So, like, dust clouds can obscure what we see in the optical, so we use other wavelengths to see through or to see structure within these clouds. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's really interesting what you can see in different wavelengths.
And apparently the Small Magellanic Cloud is visible to the naked eye, but you have to be on the right part of the Earth.
Yes, right. Southern Hemisphere, and if you catch it at the right time of year and you're at the right area in the Southern Hemisphere, yeah, you can actually see it. And I saw a hint of it when I was in the Southern Hemisphere, but not as stunningly beautiful as I'd hoped, but the weather was fairly poor when I was there. So.
Well, now, speaking of X-rays, here's Dr. Tim O'Brien, who's cutting to the bone of all your astronomical questions.
The first question this week is from Margaret Feaster. She asks, if I fall from high in the atmosphere where the gravity of the whole Earth is pulling me down, I would accelerate to high speed. So as I go faster and faster, would my mass increase? Then, if I proceeded to fall to the centre of the Earth through a handy straight tunnel, would I zoom past the centre, then fall back again, and eventually slow down to a stop at the centre, and therefore lose the mass I would have gained while speeding? I guess a simpler question would be, does a pendulum have a greater mass while it is swinging than when it stops at the bottom of its path?
It's a good question, isn't it? And the simple answer is yes. And it's all down to Einstein's special theory of relativity. And that basically tells us that the mass of a moving object is increased. And it's increased by a factor called the Lorentz factor. So we usually write it with a Greek letter gamma. And it's actually equal to, the formula for it, it's equal to 1 over the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared, where v is the velocity or the speed of the object, c is the speed of light. So it's all about how fast you're going relative to the speed of light. And so in that formula, if you can remember that formula, if you put v equals 0, so the object's not moving, you put that into that formula, this gamma factor, this Lorentz factor, comes out to 1. So that means that your mass is basically just your rest mass. You multiply it by this factor of 1, it doesn't change it. But as soon as you start moving and V gets faster and faster, then you start multiplying it by a bigger and bigger number. This gamma factor gets bigger and bigger. And it sort of rises slowly at first, but then really rapidly ramps up towards the end until it reaches the sort of ultimate limit, which is the speed of light, at which point if you plug V equals C into that formula, you'd end up with a gamma factor of infinity, actually. So it rises rapidly towards the end. Now, so in that sense, the answer is yes. As she falls in the atmosphere, as you speed up, your mass would increase. But it's actually only an infinitesimally small amount, a very tiny amount. I worked out if you were traveling in a passenger jet, so if you go on a normal sort of Boeing 747 or something, they travel at about 250 meters a second. So in that formula, which is pretty fast, but in that formula, what matters is V over C. So you have to compare that speed of 250 meters per second to the speed of light, which is 300 million meters per second. 3 × 10⁸ meters per second.
It's a lot bigger.
So that's a lot bigger than even 250 meters per second. So that would have almost no effect. I mean, you can, you know, you can accelerate particles to high fractions of the speed of light. So something like the Large Hadron Collider does it. And so we do see this effect. And if you get to something like, I mean, for example, if you take an electron or something, accelerate it through a potential difference, you can get it to maybe 99% of the speed of light, then actually its mass goes up by a factor of 7.
Factor of 7?
Yeah, so it's 7 times heavier if it's moving at 99% of the speed of light. But you do have to get up to those high velocities. So in her, in the example that we were just given, of falling towards the Earth and then falling through the middle of the Earth, which is a neat trick. As everybody knows, actually, the way to the middle of the Earth is through a volcano in Iceland. Did you know that?
No.
You need to read Jules Verne.
Oh.
So I was there recently, actually. Snæfellsjökull, it's called, the volcano. So that's where in Jules Verne's Journey to the Centre of the Earth they go through that hole. And it's not a straight tunnel either. But never mind. If we imagine this straight tunnel that goes down through the middle of the Earth, then, yeah, you'd sort of accelerate faster and faster down as you fell down that centre, down that tunnel, I should say. And, in fact, if you imagine this bizarre situation with this tunnel, it was a vacuum, and you had some breathing apparatus, I guess, and the Earth wasn't spinning round as well. If you sort of jumped off the edge and fell down the tunnel, then actually, all things being equal, you'd whiz through the middle of the Earth, right through the centre of the Earth, the centre point of the Earth.
All the way through.
All the way through. 42 minutes later, you'd pass through the middle. You'd be travelling at a speed of almost 18,000 miles an hour. But then you would sort of head out the other way, and at that point then the gravity of the Earth is sort of slowing you down. So you gradually slow down, and as I say, all things being equal, you'd just pop up again on the other side, and hopefully someone would grab you, because otherwise you'd go straight back down again and all the way back through, and you'd sort of oscillate backwards and forwards if there was no air resistance. Obviously a bit of air resistance, you'd eventually settle to the middle of the Earth. But even at that speed of 18,000 miles an hour, which is very fast, obviously, it's nearly 8 kilometres a second, even then that ratio of speed, velocity that you're travelling at compared to the speed of light is only 0.003%. So in that,
pretty tiny.
Yeah, so in that formula, that Lorentz factor, that gamma factor is still basically 1, pretty much 1. So even when you imagine that, you're not going to travel fast enough to increase your mass perceptibly.
I'm afraid. Have to be travelling really, really quickly before you'd notice anything.
Absolutely. And we do see that. We tend to see it with subatomic particles, which are, you know, easier to accelerate effectively with the sort of energy we have available.
Our second question comes from Stanley Fertig, who asks, how does a light sail work? If photons have no mass, then how can they impart momentum onto an object they hit? Or is the latter's momentum the result of a heating effect?
Yeah, so first of all, we should probably say what a light sail is, first of all. Mm-hmm. So this is this idea that you put a, it effectively works like a boat's sail, except you put this sort of big object in space, this big sail, probably not made of cloth, but something else. And then effectively the light of the sun, the radiation from the sun, the photons from the sun, so hit this sail. And as he says, the idea is that as they hit it, they basically push the sail, and that accelerates the spaceship. So you use it just like a boat you would use a sail with the wind. But for that to work, these photons have to sort of, in the collision, the photon has to transfer some momentum to the sail, to the spacecraft, for it to accelerate it. And the problem, the thing that Stanley's worried about, is the fact that photons have no mass. And what he's thinking about is this sort of classical expression for momentum, which is mass times velocity. So for momentum, we usually give it a symbol P, is equal to mv, mass times velocity. And obviously, if you had a mass of zero, your momentum would be zero, and then that mechanism couldn't work. And in fact, just sort of linking this with the last question, actually, the solution is special relativity, because in special relativity, that formula, P equals mv, is modified. So that m, that mass, is now not the rest mass, it's the relativistic mass. So that's multiplied by this factor gamma again, so the same Lorentz factor.
So the relativistic mass is just the mass multiplied by the rest factor.
Exactly, it's the rest mass multiplied by the Lorentz factor multiplied by gamma. So you've basically got this sort of formula that says that relativistic momentum is gamma m naught v, where m naught would be the rest mass. You've also got a relativistic energy, which is gamma m naught c squared. So you'll have heard of E equals mc squared.
Mm-hmm.
So what the m in that case for a moving object would be this gamma m naught. It's gamma times the rest mass m naught. So actually, you know, if you then use, if you sort of allow for that correction to standard classical sort of physics, then if you have a particle that's got no mass, so its mass is zero, but it's travelling at a speed, you know, a typical sort of speed that we might see around us, like the supersonic aircraft or something along those lines, then in those formulae, you plug in you work out a gamma factor, like we were just doing, you plug in a mass of zero, a rest mass of zero, and you get an answer of zero. So the momentum would be zero and the energy would be zero.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that would be sort of what he's saying. But the difference is, if you've got a particle with zero mass, but whose speed is actually equal to the speed of light, so if V equals C, which is what is true for a photon, which is what we're talking about here, then you use those formulae, you actually end up with an energy which is given by zero divided by zero, and you get momentum that's zero divided by zero in those formulae.
Okay.
Now that's a sort of problem mathematically, because you think, well, what's the answer to zero divided by zero? Is it because you're dividing the same two numbers together, you get the answer one, or is it because you're dividing by zero, you get the answer infinity? So in fact, it's undefined. So in principle, you could end up with any energy or momentum. Just to maybe put some more flesh on that, really, if you take those two formulae for relativistic momentum, P equals gamma mv and E equals gamma m naught c squared, and you combine them together, you get this classical formula in relativity, which is a relationship between energy and momentum, which is E squared equals P squared C squared plus M naught squared C to the fourth.
Allowing you to have a...
So that's basically relating energy to momentum and to rest mass. And so you can take that formula, if you can sort of picture it in your head, E squared is the energy, is equal to P squared C squared, P is the momentum, plus M naught squared C to the four, M naught's the rest mass. So if you put M0 equals 0, you end up with E squared equals P squared C squared, or E equals PC. And that relates energy to momentum in relativity. And for a photon does have energy. Its energy is given by the Planck constant H times its frequency, or so HF or HC over lambda in the case of a wavelength lambda. And so you can actually find an expression for the momentum of a photon, which is the energy divided by C, P equals E over C. So photons, massless objects, travelling at the speed of light, do indeed have a momentum. So that's okay. And actually, it was funny, because it made me, it stimulated me to go and look up an example of a solar sail. Because I was thinking, okay, so theoretically they are possible, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where are we with that? And I hadn't heard of this, but there's a Japanese spacecraft called Icaros, Icaros, which okay. I guess there was a play on Icarus.
I assume so.
So it's sort of the person that flew too close to the sun. So this stands for Icarus, in this case, stands for Interplanetary Kite Craft Accelerated by Radiation of the Sun, Icarus. And that was actually launched in 2010, headed towards the sun and actually passed by Venus. And that's now apparently the first spacecraft to successfully demonstrate this solar sail technology. It's in the Guinness Book of Records as the world's first solar sail spacecraft between planets. And it had a solar sail that was basically 14 metres by 14 metres. Imagine that. It's fairly large.
How big was the craft itself?
I'm not sure. I mean, it would have been, presumably, it's, you know, as you say, you'd have to make it as light as possible. In fact, I think, if I remember rightly from reading up about this, I think the cameras were very tiny that it had on it that they were using, so probably you'd try and make this thing weigh as little as possible for it to, you know, get a significant acceleration. So it would have been small, I think. I'm not exactly sure of the answer to that. But the weird thing about that, I mean, it's an interesting thing actually, is not only was it pushed by the solar wind, this radiation pressure, they also stuck some solar cells on the solar sail so that the photons was generating energy.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, so it's basically double whammy. So they were able, it was able to power its own propulsion system from some of the photons hitting the sail, as well as using the momentum of the photons hitting the sail.
That's incredibly efficient.
No, it's a neat trick. And the plan is to launch a bigger one, mm-hmm. 50 metres or so across or something like that, to head to Jupiter later in the decade.
Oh, brilliant. And we'll put some links to that on the
show
notes.
Absolutely, yeah.
Our third question comes from Rob Bowman, who says, for a lot of the work that radio astronomers do, you use a very narrow beam width to look at a tiny area of the sky. So why is electromagnetic interference from, for example, mobile phones a problem?
Yeah, sensible point, actually. And just to sort of explain what he's talking about there, he's talking about this narrow beam width. What that means is when you've got a sort of big dish telescope and you point it in a particular direction, it's effectively only seeing, we talk about it, only seeing a very small spot on the sky. And so he's effectively saying, okay, we've got this radio telescope, it's pointed over there somewhere. It's only looking in that direction. Why would you worry about a mobile phone off on the ground somewhere way off to the side? You know, what, it wouldn't even be pointing in the right direction, so it wouldn't pick it up, it wouldn't cause interference. Well, I mean, you know, in general terms, that's true. They do have these sort of these beams, and the width of the beam. We sort of think about how broad this beam is when a telescope's looking in a particular direction. It depends on the wavelength you're using and the diameter of the telescope, and the width is actually in measured in angular units of radians. It's wavelength divided by diameter. So to give an example, if we pick the Lovell telescope at Jodrell, which has a diameter of about 76 metres, and we say we were working using it at a wavelength of 21 centimetres, which is a common wavelength for us to use, that calculate that angle from lambda over d, you get about 10 arc minutes. So an arc minute is 1/60th of a degree. So 10 arc minutes is about a third the width of the full moon. So if you imagine the Lovell telescope looking up into the sky, the radio waves, it's sort of picking up from a patch on the sky about a third the size of the full moon. Now actually that means its view is blurred to that level.
So it doesn't see anything that's much
smaller than that. Much smaller than that, exactly. So that's, you know, a limitation of a single telescope, and that's why we have these big interferometer arrays where we extend them over many kilometres, 200 kilometres in the case of E. Merlin, that allows us to, you know, get synthesize a much smaller beam and look at finer detail in things on the sky. So yeah, you know, for an astronomer, a third the size of the full moon's pretty blurry and that beam's quite wide. But it still would be the case. Imagine it looking up there. You know, you think, well, if it's all coming from that direction, why does a mobile phone matter? Well, there's a couple of things really. And one is that it's not entirely true that it's all from that single beam in that direction. There's things that radio astronomers call side lobes.
Side lobes?
Side lobes, yes. And what they are, I don't know whether, if you've seen, I don't know if anybody's seen, so if some Hubble Space Telescope images, for example, of bright stars, what you see is this sort of spot of the star itself in the middle, but then around it, you might just be able to see for the brightest stars, you see these sort of circular, these concentric ripples, effectively rings of light, concentric ripples around this central bright spot. So that's basically a diffraction pattern of a point. The star's effectively a point source on the sky, and it's basically a fundamental limitation of collecting the light in an aperture, whether it's a big radio telescope or it's the Hubble Space Telescope mirror, you get this diffraction pattern. So what that means is for this radio telescope, you've got this central beam, which is the 10 arc minute wide spot at the center. But then surrounding it, there are these sort of concentric rings where you would still pick up radio waves coming from that circle around it, and then from another circle around that farther out, and so on.
So it has like its main collecting area, and then it sort of gets contaminated, for want
exactly.
of a better word.
Yeah. So in fact, in terms of doing radio astronomy on the sky, if you were looking at a really faint object in a particular point on the sky, you point your telescope at that object. If you had a really bright object off to one side somewhere that happened to be sitting on one of these side lobes, one of these ripples, what it means is you see radio waves from that as well that mix into the faint stuff you're trying to detect in your main beam. So that's called, you know, that's a confusing effect where you get those sorts of things coming in through the side lobes. Now, luckily, the side lobes are much weaker than the main beam, so they're much, so you don't, you know, you'd have to have a very strong source to detect it through the side lobe. But for something like a mobile phones are significantly brighter than the astronomical sources we're looking at. So they're really strong, bright sources. So they can come in through the side lobes, so off to one side of the telescope, of the direction we're pointing in. Plus, if you imagine sort of looking up at the Lovell telescope pointing at an angle, you can actually see the focus box where the receiver is. You can see the receiver itself depending on the angle. So if you've got a mobile phone sitting there, the mobile phone signal can see straight into the receiver. So it doesn't have to reflect off the dish and be collected at focus in the normal way, which is all this beam and side lobe business. It can just go straight in and be detected directly, or reflect off part of the structure and into the thing. So it's the very fact that they're bright that means that it still does cause a problem.
So if you're ever going to visit any of the radio telescopes, keep your phone off. And if you have any astronomical questions, then feel free to send them in via all the usual routes.
Thanks for that, Tim and Christina. Now on to the feedback. Unfortunately, we don't have any post this time round. We do have some emails, though, and I think Christina would like to read them out. So,
first of all, we've had some comments from Andy H, who's commented about our regional accents. The Jodcast volunteers come from a variety of regions within the UK and countries abroad. So, as you would expect, we do have a variety of regional accents and dialects, which is kind of representative of the wider astronomical community. And we're pretty proud of this diversity, and we do believe that the quality and clarity of the science that we discuss on the podcast is more important than the region that our volunteers come from. And on a more positive note, we've had an email from Stanley Thurtig, who says, "Love all you guys. I'm an assiduous listener while I travel the subways of NYC, but I miss Jen Gupta." As do we all.
Well, that makes me wish I was in New York, though. That's a really cool comment, really uplifting there. On the forum, Andrew H seems to have enjoyed our April Fool's episode, commenting, "Fools know our Jodcasters. Good very was edition April backwards the." So he seems to have picked up on the theme that was going on there. On Facebook, Stuart Cahoon Sr. says, "Love the show. Every month I look forward to downloading it to my iPad." And Kael Caruthers messaged us saying, "Been listening to the show for 2 years. Love it. Keep up the great work, guys." Thanks, Kael. Also, thanks for all the likes, and welcome to any new followers.
On Twitter, the special April episode had its intended effect. John Moran tweeted, "This month's Jodcast is messing with my head. Cheers, guys." And Yoda the Oak said, "You Jodcast got me all back to front." Also, apparently we've been on Twitter for 6 years now. I'm finding it hard to believe that Twitter is 6 years old. And thanks for all the retweets and follow Fridays.
And if you want to get in touch, you can do so via the website at www.jodcast.net.
The forum at forum.jodcast.net.
On Facebook at facebook.com/jodcast.
On Twitter at twitter.com/jodcast.
On YouTube at youtube.com/jodcast.
On Flickr at flickr.com/groups/jodcast.
And don't forget that you can send us posts. The address is on the website. So all that's left to say is thanks to Paolo Caselli and Shude Mao for the interviews. The editors were Sally Cooper, Christina Smith, Liz Guzman, Tim O'Brien and Mark Perver. The producer was Indy Leclerc. Until next time, Jod on!